Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the second half of the show today is Jim Williams, the author of Path of the Puma. Jim is an award-winning wildlife biologist who's been working with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks for over 27 years and is just about to release this book through Patagonia. So, Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, you've been studying these creatures for 27 years. What is it about the cougar or the puma that draws you to them?
They're really a fascinating species, and they're one of the most efficient predators on planet Earth, and they're one of the most widely distributed large carnivores on the planet. And here in Montana and the northern Rockies, along with bears and wolves, they're a lot of public interest in them as well, and I've always been fascinated by those species.
It certainly is one of those species that captures the public's attention, I think, for better or worse. So during a time when most wild animals are kind of seeing threats and declines, you talk about how the mountain lion is in some areas seeing kind of a resurgence in population. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, really, it's all about tolerance. You know, how much room can we as society make for large carnivores and for a species like a mountain lion? And if you think about it and roll the clock back a little bit, throughout the West and throughout the country, deer and elk have rebounded primarily at the interest and request of hunters through time. And when you build that prey base, that opens the door for the carnivores that will utilize it. And in this case, it's mountain lions. And we've seen a steady increase in population since the 70s. And granted, not everywhere and not across the board, but overall, particularly in North America, they're reclaiming ground they haven't been in for years.
And so do they cover pretty much all 50 states? Are they present in all 50 states?
No. That's a great question. So mountain lions are pretty much confined to the western United States and Canada and western North America, and with the exception of Florida. And what's changing is there are these stepping stone island mountain ranges like the Black Hills or the Snowies or the Judas, the Bighorns in Wyoming. You know, there's always been lions there, but densities at any given time have increased, and juvenile males and juvenile females disperse. They leave their natal areas where they were born to find new territories, new habitats to live in when their natal area is full. So they're moving along these river corridors to the east, and sometimes they're tolerated, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they get hit by a car, sometimes they make it. But that's what's going on in the central Rockies. It's a little bit different up north.
What about outside of the U.S.? How are these populations looking?
So that's another great question. So down where, you know, mountain lions are distributed pretty much almost continuously, along with other large cats and cat species, by the way, all the way down to Patagonia, to the southern tip of Argentina and Chile. So I have, you know, over the years here in western Montana, we have all these large carnivores and large ungulates and moose, sheep, and goat, and a lot of kind of high-profile species. So we've hosted lots of scientists from Chile and Argentina and gone back and forth and worked together, and their issues are remarkably similar to our issues in the West. And it's, you know, livestock depredation. Occasionally a mountain lion will prey on domestic cattle. It's tolerance, it's human safety, and competition up here with hunters at times, the perceptions thereof down there in Argentina and Chile, it's large sheep ranches and tolerance of something that can eat your livestock. And so it's remarkably similar.
So why do we need mountain lions? What role do mountain lions play in our ecosystem?
Well, mountain lions and other large carnivores across the planet have the potential to structure ecosystems from the top down at times, and then also respond to variables and factors from the bottom up. So mountain lions, deer and elk, and there's a great quote I opened one of the chapters up, and actually Edward Abbey's quote, you know, if you like a deer, thank a lion, essentially is what it is. A lot of these ungulate species have evolved, and adaptations represent, you know, behaviors fleeing from predators over time, thousands of years in some cases. So it's kind of this ancient dance between predator and prey, and mountain lions in many areas are the top of the food chain, particularly down in Patagonia and Chile and Argentina. Up here, of course, we have wolves and bears. You throw some other variables in. And then in Central America and Northern South America, you have jaguars, which are larger than the mountain lion. But we need these large carnivores to be, you know, part of a complete ecosystem. And we're still, as a field, you know, science is still discovering what these roles of top, large, keystone, apex carnivores represent in ecosystems.
So what kind of, you know, you mentioned that kind of collaboration with some of the folks working in South America and Chile and Argentina. What kind of lessons or management practices have you been able to share? Are there like some successes that have come out of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, frankly, both ways. It's amazing. And I write a little bit in the book about this in the second half. You know, when I walked into a room in Patagonia, Argentina, full of ranchers, you can pick them out right away. They hold themselves proud, heads high, unique dress, just like here in the cowboys in the West. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these ranches have been here for generations. You can pick them out. So what we've been able to do is talk about how to tolerate, when to eliminate a cat that gets into trouble versus preemptively killing all of the cats on a ranch, for instance. And so my colleagues and friends down there have made great strides working with, they're called estancias, large ranches, the size of national parks up here, by the way, to tolerate cats. And if they can do that, you're going to affect change at almost the scale or size of a national park in the West up here. So we've shared a lot of techniques to tolerate cats, and frankly, just basic information and education. And I think the more people learn about these animals, they all care. They're all interested in these species, and it's just a matter of getting the word out.
That type of, I guess, predator control, as it's often called, is also, you know, it's also something that we deal with, of course, here in Utah and in Summit County and Wasatch County. So what are some of the techniques that, you know, are being used on the estancias?
So I think, you know, we're always going to have some livestock issues with large carnivores, bears and wolves included. You know, those are non-native species on the landscape, and these carnivores are going to take advantage of the most vulnerable and opportunistic prey. Typically, that's deer for mountain lions up here, or elk, or a deer-sized animal. When we do have a problem, it's a big deal, because if you own a large ranch, you know, your livestock, you know, that's your business. So what we have done in Montana, and they've done elsewhere in the West, and we're trying to export that model down south, is rather than kill all the cats, kill the offending animal. It's unfortunate, it's regrettable, but it's not a population level impact. It's an individual cat that is focusing on livestock. The population will be fine as long as the habitat's there. So a lot of people on both continents are interested now in habitat, and that's conservation from the ground up, because if the habitat is conserved and the prey base is there, you'll have the large carnivores if we make room for them.
How much land does a typical mountain lion require, acre or square miles?
Yeah, you know, what's fascinating is the behavior of Puma concolor. That's the genus and species from the tip of South America to all the way up halfway through, you know, Alberta and British Columbia, their range. It's very similar. You know, you got home ranges around 80 square miles for a female, almost twice that for a male at times. You have densities on the landscape are similar. There's differences, but across the board, a cat's a cat's a cat. It's really quite interesting.
Wow, 80 square miles.
Yeah, potentially.
That's a huge range.
That's a big range. Yeah. So, so do... I lost my track. What about their, let's say, their annual litter or so? How much, you know, what does a mom produce or so?
So the studies I've been worked with is the average is about 2, and it can push 3. And you think about it, a kitten will stay with its mother for about a year to a year and a half. There's a pretty steep learning curve on how to take down wild prey and not get hurt, survive, eat it, wow. move on and do it again. And that takes a little bit. So a kitten's going to be with their mother, you know, up to 18 months. And I've had a few up to 2 years. And in most studies, that's pretty similar. There's been some really long-term groundbreaking work with new technology and satellite radios and infrared cameras in the last 10 years that have refined those statistics, but it's pretty similar.
Tell us a little bit more about some of the work that you've done here in the American West, some of the research that you're maybe currently working on.
Yeah, my career really can be defined or summed up in one word, and it's people. So I've spent my entire, I began in the research, just kind of the traditional, the hardcore radio caller science field work, which was wonderful. You get to literally live with these species. When I was in graduate school and when I was a young wildlife biologist in here in Montana. But I became a wildlife program manager and ended up working with all sorts of species. And I happened to, experience the recovery of wolves in the Northern Rockies. That was quite high profile and controversial. And been fortunate enough to work with some really talented grizzly bear biologists to develop our monitoring program up here in the Northern Rockies and our human conflict program. We're teaching people how to live with bears. So with between mountain lions, bears, and wolves, my career really has been defined in working one-on-one in local communities, trying to deliver conservation locally. And that's not easy to do. It takes a lot of coffee with ranchers or one-on-one time with people, but it's been great. It's been really, really meaningful for me.
Do you think making those personal connections is part of the reason for the success of some of these programs?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. I've been so fortunate to work with some super passionate biologists in Chile and Argentina and have them come up and go down. And those relationships between, biologists are a pretty small network of scientists, especially wildlife biologists in rural areas. And it's just wonderful to have those relationships and to share experiences and success stories and failures, more importantly.
How did that connection get started with, Chile and Argentina and your work in South America? What was the connection?
So my first trip down was actually part of the Partners of the Americas program. It started in the Kennedy administration years ago, and it paired South American countries with North American states. And Montana ended up being paired with Argentina, and they were having puma livestock issues. And Dr. Rick Douglas was a professor at Montana Tech at the time that helped start the Montana chapter. He asked me to go down if I'd be interested. And I remember telling him, my kids are little. I'm not sure about travel. But I ended up, he talked me into it, and away I went. And boy, it was life-changing. I fell in love with the people. I'd heard about the landscape, the food, the wildlife, but really it's the people that are just wonderful down there. Very passionate group of biologists.
We're speaking with Jim Williams. He's the author of the new book, Path of the Puma, The Remarkable Resilience of the Mountain Lion. So, Jim, you mentioned how important conversations with ranchers are, landowners like that. What about conversations with the general public? Because every time a mountain lion steps inside the city limits of Park City, it's front page news, and people get a little concerned.
Yes. So I actually used to live in Park City between undergraduate and graduate school, and it's a wonderful town. And I know personally and firsthand from climbing around the mountains there that you have mule deer and moose, but where there are deer, there are cats. Whether
yes.
you see them or not, they probably watch you. And fortunately, 99.9% of the time, their search image is for deer. Or a deer-sized animal and not people. But occasionally, a young animal gets into trouble and there is a conflict with a person or a pet, and that's always probably going to be there. I think people can rest assured that 99.9% of the time, they're looking for deer. That does mean, though, if you feed deer and you artificially concentrate them in your backyard up by the ski hill or out by Park Meadows, if you have a bunch of deer in your backyard, you're going to have what eats them as well.
Chris, you better watch out.
Well, it's funny you mention that because that's where the latest sighting was, in Park Meadows, an area of Park Meadows, in Round Valley area.
Yes.
But it is interesting that you say 99% of the time they're looking for deer. But how much percent of the time, if I'm out hiking by myself, might a cat be looking at me?
Probably more often than you realize.
Yes.
They're pretty stealthy.
That's
hence
okay.
Hence the name ghost cats.
Is
we've read,
that?
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Jim, I'm curious what was like the motivation to kind of bring all this experience and this research together into one book?
So that's a great question. When I returned from my last trip down from Chile, from this incredible movement to create new national parks in Chile by Chris Tompkins and her late husband, Doug. And it was called Conservación Patagónica at the time. Now it's simply Tompkins Conservation. What those two as a couple and what Chris is now doing now is nothing short of unbelievable on planet Earth. They're taking their entire wealth and investing it into buying literally habitat aggregations or groups of ranches the size of Yosemite and larger, creating protected areas, taking down fences, restoring native wildlife, and then giving it back to the local government, to the governments of Chile and Argentina. And that's unheard of on planet Earth right now. It's just incredible. Their legacy is amazing. So a guy got down there and was inspired by my counterpart, Christian Saucedo. He's a veterinarian and the conservation director for Chris. Just blown away by what they've done, and I really wanted to write something up and celebrate that accomplishment and help get the word out, and it just evolved into telling all the stories I had saved over the years. It was actually quite therapeutic to write the book.
give us a feel for the book. What's the I don't know, walk us through the experience of the book.
Okay. Well, when you write a book about your own career, it's relatively easy because it's firsthand, right? But as scientists, we tend to and are trained to write boring science drivel. You know, a typical peer-reviewed research paper, a study
sure.
area, method, discussion. Well, I learned real quickly writing a book for non-biologists and, you know, for everyone here and abroad even. I wanted to really get that message out. You mentioned the general public. That's what I wanted to do. We fail as scientists to write to non-scientists. And so I really wanted to do that. And I learned real quickly that is very difficult. And so I was very fortunate. Patagonia, Carla Olson's the director of books down at Patagonia. She's building this incredible recreation and conservation genre down there in a book department when people are kind of moving more toward, you know, iPhones and audio and away from hard books. Carla's building this genre, and she paired me with some brilliant editors that essentially had their literary way with me, and I had me rewrite, and they were right. I mean, to make it readable and entertaining. So that was my personal firsthand experience. Is I have a whole new profound respect for professional writers and their craft. It's just amazing how talented they are, coming from a scientist, right?
Mm-hmm.
But my book starts in, there's a little bit of personal autobiography, which, you know, is usually required, and it was kind of fun to tell. I started in San Diego and bounced around through undergrad and graduate school, but I started in Montana, and I literally talk about kind of more traditional research on these magnificent animals and what we've learned and some of the issues up here in the Northern Rockies, whether it's population management or habitat conservation, what have you, or tolerance. And then I transitioned down to Argentina and the amazing work done on the windy steppes of Argentina. And then I finished in Chile in the Tompkins Parks. And it's kind of a fun journey. And, you know, for a lot of folks, you know, you live in the Rockies. I live in the Rockies. We take it for granted. You know, we live in a pretty magical place, a pretty wonderful area with public lands and all these species. And the same is true with Patagonia. You know, they're pretty similar, yet wonderful places for wildlife and outdoor recreation. And it was fun to write it up and tie it all together.
We only have a few minutes left. I got one question. Of course, it'll take you like 8 minutes to answer, but but it has to do with sports hunting. Now, in the state of Utah, it's difficult to quantify the exact the number of mountain lion, let's say in Utah. It's an estimated by the DWR as some 4,000 mountain lion in the state. And those populations have been increasing year over year, like you said, healthy populations. But also the number of permits that are being allowed for hunters to go out and hunt these cats. Limits on different sections of the states. It's not just, you know, some 1,200 or 1,500 permits or so. But those number of permits are also increasing. Put you on the spot here. What do you think about sports hunting for mountain lions?
It's actually a great question, and it applies to a lot of species. So we tend to, as biologists, and I'm sure in Utah, and well, I know colleagues down there, researchers and biologists and other Western states, we focus on populations, not individuals. So you're going to have that value. My personal value, do I think an animal should be, you know, taken and eaten or taken legally with a license and whatever means in any given state? That's a personal value, and everyone's going to vary, you know, what color do you like? But biologists are going to focus on, is the habitat there and what's the population status? And so where that gets kind of messy is, okay, if you got large private ranches in many areas in the West, most biologists are going to manage somewhat to landowner tolerance. And as they can get more acceptance for native ungulates or carnivores, they'll do that versus in areas with large blocks of public land or wilderness where you can manage, essentially have a very natural density of large carnivores on the landscape and have it be tolerated. So it's going to vary throughout the West. But what I always tell folks, you know, when I get this question is, you know, defer to your local biologist. Most of them have graduate degrees and they live and breathe these species. And yeah, there's political influence, you bet. Is there landowner influence? You bet. But these biologists want to do the right thing. And it's all about populations. And the beauty of science, and this is why science is so important in research, is we now know, you know, the percentage of the population. It's easy to knock populations back. It's also easy to let them return. And what's neat about that is if you take a look and go down to Chile and Argentina, where cats were eliminated, they're Patagonia puma, a little bit larger in my mind, a little lighter colored. But we know from data up here, working with hunting seasons and population management, that we can, you know, have a population rebound in 3 to 5 years to a natural density with all their life history traits, you know, remaining the same. So we've learned a lot through hunting seasons as well. But your question, it's going to vary on the area in Utah and what the pressures are externally versus a hands-off approach and having a natural density. So it's a complicated question. It's going to vary geographically with your land ownership is my guess.
Okay.
Well, before we let you go, we want to highlight the fact that you'll be in Utah next week, right?
Yes. I'm going to do a presentation. So I'll be out on a fun book tour and I'm going to have a visual, probably 30 to 40 minute, take people, some of the photos and experiences and side stories that are mentioned in the book and take them out a little further and kind of bring people on a little journey visually, you know, between Argentina and the crown of the continent here in Montana and down to Chile. And of course, sign books and answer questions, but I want to take people there visually. I live and breathe this. I love it. And it's just a special part of the world down there and up here. And they're remarkably similar, which is amazing.
And so you will be at the Patagonia store in Salt Lake on September 19th at 7 p.m.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's really fun to hear about your experience working with these incredible animals. And we'll see you next week.
Yes.